Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You are listening to Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Jaka. Today we are talking about a thing that most people have a love-hate relationship with, the internet. We could probably do a million stories on the internet and never be done exploring it all, but we limited it down to 30-ish minutes of Real College Podcast, which starts right now. March always means two really big things. The first is that it's my birthday, which, to be fair, might only be a big deal to me, but I think it still counts. The other is March Madness. In middle school, I remember people filling out paper copies of their brackets and comparing them during class. Now a lot of that has gone digital. Grant and Trask took a look into how the internet has forever changed March Madness.
The first ever NCAA basketball tournament championship was held on March 27, 1939. It began with eight teams and progressively became the 68-team tournament it is today. In 2001, the current 64-team bracket system was introduced. The 64 teams were divided into four regions, and every team that wins a region continues on to the Final Four. Popular nicknames have emerged for each stage of the tournament, such as Sweet 16, Elite 8, and Final Four. The championship game is moved to a new host city every year, often in new stadiums or venues. U.S. Bank in Minneapolis will host the 2019 championship game. The most successful team in the tournament history are the UCLA Bruins, winning 11 championships with 10 coming under head coach John Wooden. The University of Kentucky is second with 7 titles. The NCAA held its first women's basketball tournament in 1982. The Tennessee Volunteers have won 6 championships under head coach Pat Summitt. The Connecticut Huskies are second with 5 championships.
The NCAA, like all sports, has evolved with technology. When it comes to picking the 68-team bracket, there is much less of the gut-feeling aspect to the committee. The selection committee consists of 10 people who are either collegiate athletic directors or conference commissioners. Nowadays, the committee uses more research techniques and dives deeper into the statistical analysis of the game. All of this new information is available thanks to the internet. In an email conversation with Dr. Tom Paskus, the principal research scientist at the NCAA, he explained to me how the committee will often call on him for his expert opinion on certain statistical aspects, mainly his viewpoint on current RPI rankings, which combines the wins, the strength of schedule, and the opponent's strength of schedule of a team to form a more wholesome ranking system. The internet hasn't just changed the way the NCAA deals with the tournament, however. The fans have also changed as well.
The internet has also taken March Madness, which began as a basketball tournament, and exploded it into a multi-million dollar collection of games. Simple wagers between family and coworkers in the mid-1900s turned into a worldwide phenomenon that captures the attention of gamblers and non-gamblers alike. With technology and the internet, simple paper brackets in homes and offices have almost become obsolete. Anyone and everyone can play for free on their laptop or phone. Multiple apps and bracket platforms offer rewards to the person who can create the near-perfect or best bracket. People are drawn to the tournament because of the drama and suspense, and the hope that they will win real money. By 2005, college basketball had become the most popular sporting event among gamblers, second after the Super Bowl. The internet has provided nearly unlimited stats and real-time updates on players, coaches, and game-time conditions. Real-time stats allow for the average fan to become a wealth of knowledge when selecting teams and to make it into the next round. The internet has taken power away from the TV broadcaster and the ESPN hosts and placed it into the hands of the average basketball fan. We were able to have a phone interview with Nick Dodge and discussed with him the correlation between March Madness, the internet, and business. Nick Dodge works for Sally's Saloon, and Grant Sandberg has the interview.
First, I just wanted to know, how is business overall affected during the March Madness tournament in terms of whether it's better, more revenue or something like that?
I would say the revenue doesn't really go up or down. We just have a different crowd in there.
Different crowd.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what we like to call sitters. So you got people that are coming in, they find a comfortable spot to sit because they're going to be there for a good majority of the day and they're going to be watching sports.
Makes sense. Over the past, like, decade or so, with, like, all the new technology and the internet and, like, online bracket competitions and streaming games, has that changed how the business has been affected?
Absolutely.
In what sense would you say?
With the brackets and the online brackets, I think people just get their information faster, and they don't necessarily need to be watching 10 different channels at a time, keeping track of the games. I mean, really, you can kind of just keep up. You don't necessarily even have to be at a venue to watch. You can watch everything from your phone in real time.
Yeah.
So I think business has actually dropped down tremendously over the last 5 or 6 years just because of that.
Okay. And then one more question. Do you guys do anything special to like use March Madness as like a marketing tool or something to try to bring more people in during this time?
No, we don't. March Madness for us is kind of one of those things that sells itself. We've got a pretty good viewing section. If you've ever been into Sally's, we've got some nice TVs in there. We've got some big screens, and I think that's a pretty good sell on its own. We continue running our normal specials, which are already fairly aggressive with both food and beverage as well. We have done some specials in the past. I shouldn't say that we don't ever do it, but it's not something that we really target. It's not a target market of ours, only because we already have people coming in to watch the games as it is.
All right. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
The way we use the internet is not just a product of culture or technology companies. It also relies on federal regulations which govern the internet as we know it. Following the FCC decision to repeal net neutrality, these regulations have come to the forefront of political and media debate. But what exactly is net neutrality, and why are these regulations important? Real College podcast producer Ben Hallam spoke to Steve Kelly, a senior fellow at the Humphrey School for Public Affairs, and Joe Kansten, professor of computer science at the U of M, to find out more.
Net neutrality has been making big headlines since the Federal Communications Commission voted to repeal it on December 14, 2017. But it's a regulation that has only been around for 2 years. Since the 2015 Open Internet Order, passed by the Federal Communications Commission under the Obama administration. To find out more about this original rule and the rationale for its repeal, I sat down with Steve Kelly, a senior fellow at the Humphrey School for Public Affairs.
The key issue that was in the rule that had been adopted by the Federal Communications Commission during the Obama administration was that people who provided internet access could not block or throttle or otherwise charge discriminatory prices for internet content, for getting access to the internet. Some people called that the open internet, or we call it internet neutrality or net neutrality, because the internet service provider has to be neutral across all the different people that are wanting to send traffic over the internet.
So what are some of the reasons behind the repeal of this regulation, which the Federal Communications Commission had only recently passed?
So with President Trump's administration, there was a new chairman, new membership on the Federal Communications Commission. So the internet service providers petitioned them to look at the rule again, and the FCC acted to repeal those existing rules and to adopt a rule requiring transparency in the transactions that you did. The arguments in favor by the big internet service providers were that they would invest more in the net and that that would improve service for everybody if they could manage it and get additional revenue from providing service to certain kinds of customers. It's hard to evaluate that because the issues related to investment in the infrastructure haven't been at the sort of large and urban scale. The places where we haven't invested as much is in rural areas where it's high cost and there are relatively few customers. And there were no promises made by the internet service providers that they would invest in these other areas for higher speed or more access as a result of this change. So they argued that there would be more investment. And that tends to be what the big providers argue when they're trying to get a rule that's financially beneficial to them, is that some of that money would go to improving the network. Of course, the other reality is that that money sometimes just goes to increase shareholder return or more profits for the internet service provider.
Do you expect that this FCC decision will actually spur further investment in internet infrastructure?
We didn't see before the Obama administration a big increase in investment. And when the Obama administration passed the rule, we didn't necessarily see a large decrease in investment as a result of having a net neutrality rule. So it's hard to predict the future, but I'd be surprised if we're going to see any big increase in access or speeds or other kinds of things on the internet as a result of the new action by the FCC under Chairman Pai.
After discovering why net neutrality has been repealed, I sat down with Professor Joseph Constant, professor of computer science and engineering at the University of Minnesota, in order to understand why we might want net neutrality.
So the arguments for net neutrality primarily come down to three. For consumers, the idea that you can get whatever you want and feel like you're going to get equally good service. If things are slow, you buy a faster connection, but you don't have to buy piecemeal that I have to pay more to get good service on Facebook or YouTube because that's a separate price. For businesses, the main argument for net neutrality is that it enables startup businesses to really come in and start on the internet just by plugging in and getting a connection. Right now, if you want to start a new video company, you can do that. And anybody on the internet can use your video company, just like if you had a telephone service, anybody could call your telephone number. Whereas if we get rid of net neutrality, as it looks like the FCC is going to do, then suddenly a new business might not be able to deliver things at high speed over the internet unless they negotiate a special deal with each and every internet service provider. And so your video company would probably never get off the ground unless you somehow partnered with a big company that had those deals in place.
Why do you think companies shouldn't be allowed to charge consumers differently for different types of services like social media, video streaming, and other types of internet access?
Personally, I think this is the challenge we have with anything that's trying to be a utility. We deal with this with electricity or with water. We don't let the electric company say, I'm going to charge you more if you have something valuable in your house running on electricity. You know, your refrigerator, I'll charge you this amount per hour, but your computer, I'm going to charge you three times as much because people with computers have more money. But it is an argument that is this really about a utility or is this really about dividing up the pie of revenue on the internet?
Would you say that internet service is a utility?
I think it is right now. I think the arguments are, you know, is it a competitive market and is it naturally something where there's only going to be a couple of providers? If you look in the US right now, it's not a very competitive market. In most communities, you have exactly two companies, the cable TV company and the phone company that provide wires to your home. In much of the country, there's zero or one provider when you get into rural America. And I think that's a reason for it to be a utility.
As shown by the repeal of net neutrality, the regulation of the internet is sure to be a political discussion for years to come, with internet access impacts for all Americans. For Real College Podcast, I'm Ben Hallam.
As far as disruptive technology goes, Spotify is probably one of the biggest of our times. It has forever changed the way we listen to music and the way artists get paid. A band that makes it big on Spotify can have their whole lives changed. Nathan Fervoy talked to a band that had just that happen to them.
It's late afternoon in an apartment on Chicago's north side, and the boys are chilling. The table is a mess, as always, with ash and greasy paper bags. There's a bong to one side with a tray of dried moon sand underneath. They focus on the TV on low volume where the men who stare at goats are playing. Nothing is out of the ordinary as one of them retweets a fan before checking the band's email. 8,000 miles away, west across the Rockies and out over the Pacific Ocean, a girl is laying on her back staring up at the ceiling. She hasn't felt like herself in months. Mind all scattered at this new school. Nothing seems to hold her interest like it used to. In this very moment, through the white Apple headphone in her ear, something pulls her attention together from the ceiling. The song she's never heard before, but the crooning vocals feel familiar and fresh all at once. Pulled into the song, she plays it back, this time following the movement of the trumpet over the bouncy rhythm. Fully immersed in the song on her third listen, she connects to the emotional tone and finds clarity of mind for the first time in a long time. Some weeks later, she reaches for a computer and begins typing a message.
To my new favorite band, Man Wolves.
I don't wanna play these games.
Streaming is simple and streamlined on the surface, but within the context that it fills, with the shifting and shifty music business to one side and the deep passions of music fans on the other, nothing is quite so simple. Every minor detail and arbitrary feature of a massively popular streaming platform has the potential to carve out new pathways to success for thousands of artists like the Man Wolves. I was shocked to witness their rise in popularity from a local following to 3 million streams on Spotify, seemingly overnight. It's hard to wrap my mind around long-term friends suddenly being thrust into the spotlight, where familiar lyrics and subtle jokes seem inflated into something much greater, with a million sets of ears judging out of context. The recent explosion in popularity for the Man Wolves draws on the streaming platform Spotify, which has ballooned itself from 5 million paid subscribers in 2013 to over 60 million in 2017, not to mention the 90 million additional free users. The design of platforms like Spotify tap their massive reach to allow fast ascents from the local to the international. The mechanics of Spotify are playlist-centered, emphasizing personal preference and continual music during any possible situation. There's music for studying, music for running, music for starting your day, music to fall asleep to. Streaming thus represents a shift in listening and music discovery habits, from autonomous and self-selected to a more catered mode of discovery. The sorting of music into generated tight playlists does more than sort. Artists who get placed into a popular playlist can gain immediate exposure to millions of potential fans. Attempting to study in my poorly heated living room one afternoon, I was caught off guard by a familiar sound drifting off my roommate's laptop speakers. Confused, I checked the queue and found that the algorithm had naturally dropped my friend's song right into my roommate's personalized Discover Weekly playlist. The band themselves had no clue that the algorithm was looking out for them, and only realized when the rest of us did.
What, like, how we found out was, like, my girlfriend's friend followed that playlist, like, the top viral.
Yeah.
Sent a screenshot to my girlfriend, who sent that screenshot to me, and I was hotboxing. Me and Harris were hotboxing the Mini Cooper with the wood, and I was just like, "No fucking way!" I was like, "I'm no baby."
Along with the initial clout from their inclusion in the viral top 50, another influencing factor likely boosted the Man Wolves' favorability with Spotify's type algorithm. Reading through YouTube comments on a Man Wolves video recently, a friend and I laughed hysterically at strangers' strange impressions of her friends.
Kinda sound like 21 Pilots.
Almost reminded me of Sublime.
Man Wolves almost reminded me of Sublime.
Ska Hop?
And Maroon 5, I don't know.
The diverse set of reactions, while funny to us, are a key to their success. The band itself offers no exact description of their sound, flirting with genres of hip-hop, jazz, and rock without ever sticking to one. The range of comparisons on their YouTube comments represent not only a broad influence on the Mad Wolf sound, but also the appeal to multiple genres of music at once. Going through the list of Spotify playlists which include the Mad Wolves, some generated and some fan-made, it's clear how genre ambiguity has played to their benefit.
Okay, so we're on Discover Weekly, we're on people's like Your Daily Mix, we're on this playlist called Low Key, we're on a bunch of people's top songs for 2017.
Uh-huh.
We're on this playlist Guest List Juan Carlos Lobajo. I'm not so titty sucking music. We're on the playlist Jazz Hip Hop R&B Fusion, Chill Hip Hop Essentials, Didn't Make the Cut. Hungover chills.
The Mad Wolf sound reflects their most direct inspirations from contemporaries in the Chicago scene, namely Kids These Days and the now massively successful Chance the Rapper. An extremely segregated city, Chicago's south and north sides presented separate scenes waiting to be merged. A bustling rap scene on the south contrasted by the live rock underbelly of the north side. The contentious history of music with race, the two sides of the city playing off one another, is present within this music. The immense success of Chance's live instrumental rap highlighted the national demand for such a merger of sounds and paved the way for acts like the Mad Wolves by creating a large, young fan base in search of more. Streaming represents an attempt at readjustment during the digital age for a music industry which struggled through the rise of the MP3 in place of the lucrative compact disc. Without the need for a physical copy, the internet and ease of file sharing removed the industry's death grip on distribution, a system that previously granted total control over pricing and over which artists could be heard at all.
I don't know, what y'all think about it? I think it's a cool, artists could be paid better, but I think that it is a good way for music to be heard on a mass scale.
For up-and-coming and active artists, distributing their streamable music now serves as a means for creating popularity.
Dude, it's really just like, we just put up our music and people really fucked with it, and then it just spread along, because it's really easy to spread with streaming. And it's not like the mindset like, oh, we're finna make money off these folks.
Yeah.
It was more of just like, damn, all these folks like hit us up. Do we have a decent following in these places? Because that would be sick if we can play a show out there. Because, like, streaming was, like, it's the reason we're able to, like, go out of state, real talk.
The tangled reality of streaming is that it cannot pay on its own. Once guaranteed royalties for successful artists are no longer dependable, which becomes a problem for artists who cannot tour constantly. Popularity does not transfer directly to financial return under streaming. Financial return requires active cultivating. So stepping away from music grows nearly impossible for the artist. Americans listened to an average of 32 hours of music per week in 2017. This is up by 5.5 hours since only the year prior. Streaming surely drives a staggering leap. It is strange to watch my friends, as familiar to me as my own left arm, being thrown into this global scrambling machine of humanity and shot out into the speakers of millions. Strong reactions from strangers are inevitable with such a high number of listeners. There's the timeless story of the fan with the band logo tattoo.
She was just like a big fan of ours and like friends with like a homie of ours. And she just upped it and got a tattoo of our logo. He sent the picture of her like in the tattoo parlor getting a tattoo. And I was just like, no. Like, and it's big, dude. It's like the size of my fist. It's like big.
And then there are the stranger, more delicate reactions, intimate moments shared from across the globe.
One time this girl from some Southeast Asian country, she messaged us and was like, hey, I'm a high school student at an American school and blah blah blah, wherever she was, and she told us that Mad Wolves was the reason that she beat her depression.
Yeah.
And that's pretty cool.
In the unexpected collision of far apart lives like this, with the music of some ugly boys from the north side of Chicago impacting the happiness of a girl struggling worlds away, the power of a massive platform like Spotify is felt. a mixing and merging between the lives and styles of total strangers connected by the internet.
20,000 people follow this? We're all nasty.
Hola, we need some quality time. You and me, girl, we gon' be alright. You and me, girl, we gon' be just fine.
This next piece is a rerun from an earlier episode. Ben Hallam tried to figure out what the heck a Bitcoin actually is. It's been a pretty big year for Bitcoin because since January, their value was up to $14,600. It has since dropped to about $7,800. Bitcoin has become pretty mainstream, including the fact that it's now a part of the stock exchange and people try to guess the future of it. Its swift rise can be a little bit surprising if, like many people, you're really not sure what it is. And so that's exactly what Ben Hallam did. He talked to people at the U of M's cryptocurrency club to find out, once and for all, what the heck is a Bitcoin?
Suppose you have an online banking account like most people do now, and they send money to pay bills and so forth. They aren't physically sending cash anymore. It's all done electronically. With Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies in general, kind of takes this a step further. Instead of relying on centralized entities like your bank in order to process this transaction for you, you actually rely on computers all over the world to process this transaction. And so you just tell the network that you would like to send money to one person. It's recorded through thousands of computers around the world, and then it's verified by thousands of other computers around the world. And so you have a situation where you can still transfer money, but in this case, it's you directly sending money to them through this distributed system instead.
How does this distributed system work? What types of computers make up the network? And how do they secure Bitcoin transactions?
Okay, so there are really two types of computers that process this information. So first are called nodes. These store a history of all the transactions that have ever taken place. These transactions are grouped together into blocks. These blocks contain the most recent 10 minutes of transactions for Bitcoin. And then every 10 minutes, they'll just keep adding on these blocks. And collectively, these blocks form the blockchain, which is just the history of all the transactions that have ever happened. The second component are miners. These are the ones that actually secure the network. So you have a lot of computers competing against each other to see who will actually solve this next block, to see who can actually verify these transactions. It's a bunch of computers basically solving a guess and check problem. And since there is a lot of competition and no one controls it, it's uncertain who will actually solve this problem, and that's actually what keeps it secure.
How does the process of solving these blocks create new Bitcoin for the miners?
So with Bitcoin, you have a set algorithm with how new coins are created, and miners are incentivized to actually participate in the first place based off this reward. You'll have a new block, and in this case, suppose that it's indicated that there will be 10 more Bitcoin generated this block. The person who solves this will get that 10 Bitcoin and any fees that they collect when processing the transactions.
Who is mining for Bitcoin, and what sort of equipment do they need?
With mining, specifically with Bitcoin, people typically use specialized hardware. It's called an ASIC, a special computer that is very good at doing one thing only, mining Bitcoin. But with other cryptocurrencies, it's still possible to mine on your normal CPU, so your normal computer, and many people still mine stuff on GPUs, so with their graphics cards. And these can be run by really anyone. So it's not one entity that's really doing it. Anyone has the opportunity to participate in mining, and it's basically kind of like a race, so you have a chance at a reward to be compensated for actually solving the block.
How has the process of mining Bitcoin changed as the cryptocurrency has gained popularity?
It's definitely been a story of a transition. So with Bitcoin, when it launched, most people, or very few people, knew about it. It could be mined on your normal computer, like your laptop could mine 50 Bitcoin pretty easily, and that's worth tens, hundreds of thousands of dollars now. And it later transitioned to using your graphic card because they were more specialized, and then people eventually developed ASICs to work with this algorithm. Now, if you try to mine Bitcoin with a CPU, it's basically worthless. You can mine for over 10 years and likely not get anything. And that's completely different to when it started off. And if you had an ASIC, you'd just be like miles ahead of other people that are just using non-specialized hardware.
Much of the news coverage surrounding Bitcoin has focused on its rising value, while also questioning how firmly this value is grounded in reality. Do you think Bitcoin's value is going to continue to rise, or are we due for some sort of corrective price fall in the future?
I think in the short term you're likely to see a correction just because you've seen significant increases over the past several weeks. It's grown from, in a very short period of time, from like $8,000 to $15,000. And so I'm really bad and I don't really like to speculate about long-term prices and so forth. Ultimately, the price of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies is just based off supply and demand. Like, if more people are willing to buy it than sell it, the price goes up and vice versa. So it is really hard to put a price value to it. Like, for instance, when you're valuing stocks, you typically have revenues and so forth to base off. With cryptocurrencies, it's more of like an idea. So with Bitcoin, the fundamental value that, in my opinion, it provides is just a very high level of security. And so it's very difficult to value these really intangible items. And as such, it's really hard for people to really evaluate it.
Once you've mined a Bitcoin, what can you do with it? Where can you go to buy something with Bitcoin?
Very few merchants actually accept Bitcoin directly. So you have Newegg, you used to have Steam, but they recently stopped accepting Bitcoin just because Bitcoin's transaction fees have grown large. However, there are very easy on and off ramps, so it's very easy to convert Bitcoin back to dollars to spend. And I think that there's still interest in accepting cryptocurrencies in general, but we've just seen very large fees where an average transaction might cost $3 or $4 to send. I think that just speaks partially to a limitation of the efficiency of cryptocurrencies.
What do you see as the future for distributed systems technologies like Bitcoin? Are there any further applications being developed for this technology?
You will see systems built on top of Bitcoin and other private C systems, because I think that's the clearest advantage you can get out of a decentralized system. But you do see really cool projects too, for example with Ethereum, where you can have the ability to make decentralized applications. So instead of going to a specific website for an individual service, for example like eBay or something, you could theoretically make that distributed so that everyone runs those applications throughout the whole network. For instance, if you wanted to go to eBay, you would connect to their servers and download the website and communicate with them specifically. With Ethereum and decentralized applications and so forth, you communicate with the rest of the nodes in the network. It's kind of like a virtual system that's created throughout all these computers around the world, and you communicate with them instead. And I know there's a lot of interest in the space at trying to develop those items. So you have some promising projects there, and you have even more that aren't very promising, but that's just kind of what you have to deal with in the space now, where everyone's trying to make money, and you need to kind of ignore those that are just trying to scam you.
I'm Ben Helm for Radio K's Real College Podcast. It's
That is all for this week's episode of Real College Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K. It's supported by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. It's produced by Ben Hallam, Liv Riggins, and Alex Schumacher. I'm your host and managing editor, Jacob Maldonado Medina. Thank you so much for listening. Head over to radiok.org/realcollegepodcast to listen to all of our old episodes. You can also subscribe on iTunes and make sure that you tune in every Monday at 6:30 for more arts and cultural coverage.